In last year's State of the Nation address, the president signaled a renewed focus on healthcare, from advancing the national health insurance rollout to infrastructure upgrades for hospitals and clinics to responding to the loss of major foreign funding from PEPFAR and USAID. Health is not abstract policy. It is the difference between life and death, ability and disability, hope and despair for millions of South Africans. Our guest today, Matshidiso Lengwasa, is a budget expert from Section 27, the Public Interest Law Centre, that tracks government policy and spending on essential services. She's here to help us assess whether these promises moved beyond rhetoric into real change. The question today isn't what was promised. The question is, what has been delivered? And what does that mean for ordinary South Africans? Matshidiso, in last year's SONA, lots of promises, lots of big words, especially in the health sector. And three of the things that the president spoke about quite firmly, might I add, NHI and its funding. It was also in the wake of PEPFAR and USAID cutting by Donald Trump and how he'd be responding to that. And then he talked a lot about infrastructure. So if we strip away all of the fancy language that he uses, this promise, do you think that they were concrete commitments that he gave?
Yeah, so I think me, just like many other people across the country, have started to see the SONA as something of great political promises, a lot of promises. But then, you know, 2 weeks later, the budget speech is always tabled, and it seems that they water down those promises that are made, you know. So there are commitments, like you mentioned, towards the NHI. There was also, the SONA was given at a time where doctors, unemployed doctors, were protesting because they were not being absorbed into the public health sector, you know, which is a crazy, like, just the state of the country, the real state of the nation. How do we have unemployed doctors in a context where we need healthcare and we need, you know, and we need both healthcare and we also have an unemployment crisis? And so that was, that happened. And also, like you mentioned, the PEPFAR withdrawal. So the health sector, there was a lot moving around that. And then, of course, the political side of it, which with the NHI. But then when it came to the budget speech, I think that it was that first GNU budget, which it struggled to be tabled. And I think a big part of it was also because on the one hand, I think the promises, the rhetoric, South Africa were really good at that. But when it comes to implementation and budget, I think that's really the true test of these promises. And I think that this year, when we do listen into the SONA, we should be listening with that ear. Like, yes, it's easy to say we're going to do this, we're going to do that. But the real truth of how committed you are to it is whether you're willing to put money behind that.
So let's start talking about money. Let's start by looking at the funding and the funding shortfall. You referenced the budget. So was there money eventually allocated? And did the provinces get that money?
Yeah. So, economics can be, it's a lot of instruments to get to the bottom line. But basically, in theory, this was, last year's budget was the first time that health received so much money in a context where the health sector was being defunded. So we had the COVID pandemic, but even before that, there had been interventions by government to reduce our public sector wage bill, which the impact of that was that they were not hiring as many doctors, nurses, teachers, because I think we all know that if you go into a public clinic or a public hospital, you can see that there's understaffing and there's under-resourcing. There were backlogs also exacerbated by the COVID crisis. And so it had been a long time coming of civil society and just the country at large complaining, and rightfully so, that their right to access quality healthcare services had been compromised because we weren't investing in it in the same way. And so this year, last year's budget that followed the SONA 2025 was one that actually increased healthcare, but it was contentious because the way that they had increased it or how they envisioned it was by increasing VAT, which would mean that prices would go up to procure healthcare services. So it wasn't actually an increase. So we as civil society, and I think as a country, pushed back against that. And eventually they did scrap, they did scrap the VAT increase. This year's budget, and this year's SONA is a different context, right? Because for the first time, I think that SARS has raised more money than we ever have. So we have higher than expected revenues, and then we also have windfall taxes. So I think Treasury and the government is in a good fiscal position, not perfect, but better than we have in the previous years. And so it actually is an opportunity to table a SONA that's not just rhetoric or promises, and then 2 weeks later a budget that doesn't commit to it. But I think this is an opportunity to actually fill the gaps or rebuild the public sector the public healthcare sector that had been disinvested in. And I think also the other priority would be making sure that all of this money that will be probably spoken about in the SONA, every single rand actually goes towards the intended beneficiaries. Because what we also have also seen after the SONA is that we have these promises in the SONA around NHI, around hiring doctors and infrastructure, but then a lot of money gets returned by provinces and provincial health departments and they don't spend it. And so it's like we're being taxed, we're taking on all of this debt, but is it actually translating into the right to healthcare being realized for all people in this country? Well, definitely not. But here's an opportunity to change that.
So the money was allocated. The promise was made in SONA. The money was allocated. It was there and it went down to provincial level. And yet we still see a sector that is struggling for many different reasons. In your view and with your experience, what is the problem? Is it a lack of political will to do things? Is it a lack of skill and management to do the right thing? Is it a combination? Or what is the problem?
Yeah, so it's definitely all of the above. So I think the first thing is that because there have been budget cuts. So it's firstly that it's still not enough money, unfortunately. But I guess the question will then be, what will enough money look like? But over the past decade, they had been disinvesting in health, right? So there had been programs like health infrastructure that have actually been receiving nominal cuts. So they've been cutting the budget directly. And so it's not going to take just overnight and say, hey, we're restoring this. There's been years of disinvestment. So we need to reverse that. And that's not going to happen overnight. In fact, the finance minister had told me directly and said, we see the error, but it won't happen overnight. We need to rebuild. And I think that's the language that we should be using and looking at a SONA that actually rebuilds the public healthcare system. So that's one area of it. The other, I think, that you pointed out correctly is around capacity of the state, right? So there are programs, especially around infrastructure, like building new clinics, building new hospitals and infrastructure around that, that is subject to corruption. I think we've seen a lot of, the Matlanga Commission right now, one of the big stories around Vusikat Matlalo was around Tembisa Hospital, like that was 2 billion. And when we look at the numbers as budget analysts, we didn't even know that they had that 2 billion that could be stolen. So it's, we first have not enough resources. And then of those little resources, they're not actually going to the people for a variety of reasons. Capacity, but also the capacity of the state to spend the money, but also to hold people accountable in the face of corruption or irregular expenditure. And so, again, president last year had spoken a lot in the SONA around we need to build a capable state, a state that is capable, a capable state. And again, it just seems like words if you're not actually going to commit to, investing in what a capable state looks like. Will there be consequence management for underspending and poor spending? What happens with our procurement as a state? Why does it take so long for infrastructure projects to be realized? Like, why does it take so long to build a clinic when we do we struggle with the capacity? I think we need to be seeing things like trainings and workshops, because there are some provinces that are better than others at spending the money. So there are a variety of problems from a fiscal, from a budget perspective perspective. And I think also you're right, like the political will, because the budget is also an exercise, and the SONA is an exercise on politics. May the most powerful win. And if, you know, some programs like infrastructure, they're the more powerful ones because people experience the real state of the nation at their clinics or at their hospitals. And if the clinic is falling apart, that's the first urgent thing. But there are other areas like emergency medical services, getting an ambulance, like people across the country, especially in the Eastern Cape and rural communities, struggle to get an ambulance and it never arrives. But that hasn't been a trending topic, and so it doesn't get the funding in the same way. So there are, it is really just all of the above. But like I said, instead of going through the cycle of all of this political promise and these big speeches and who was wearing what and what happened at the SONA, and then 2 weeks later we have a budget that's like completely different, now is actually the opportunity, if ever, over the past decade we've been removed from the grey list, there are opportunities for us to actually rebuild our healthcare sector and do more than it just being promises. We can actually hold the president to account to these promises that he makes.
So talking about funding and all of these gaps that exist, there has then been opportunity, I will call it, for external players, as in NGOs such as yourself, a big one and lots of talk because of the way that Donald Trump did it. One of the first things that he did when he arrived on the 20th of Jan last year as president of the USA is scrap funding for USAID, which impacted PEPFAR for us, which I think the minister said accounted for about 17% of what we were spending on HIV/AIDS programs. In your world and what you have seen, what impact has that had a year on?
I mean, it's been devastating. Because, and I think that a lot of organizations, like even Spotlight, which is our health journalism arm, has been doing a lot of work documenting these stories, right? But it has actually had a devastating impact because, and what's most pronounced for me, you know, also as a young Black woman, is that there were a lot of jobs that were lost because of this, because, you know, the PEPFAR interventions is one thing of getting people to access medication. And it is, and I think it was an important conversation around how do we fund a healthcare system that serves our country, you know, and making sure that it's not volatile to international, like, because we don't have a say in who becomes the president of America or anything. But what can we do to make sure that we uphold the right to healthcare no matter what, right? And now I bring up our experiences and seeing what had happened is that when that funding had been pulled away and all the NGOs were defunded, a lot of community healthcare workers, you know, or people who do work in the communities lost their source of income, right? And source of income, but also their opportunity to serve their communities in that way. And so it has an impact on our country, yes, in our health outcomes, but also on our unemployment crisis, of which, you know, young Black women are the ones who bear the crisis or considered the face of unemployment. That was actually an opportunity to both serve the country and build healthy communities and be the front line, but also it was an opportunity for people to earn their own living and build, you know, and build their own futures, right? And so that has been a huge impact on that. And so what the government then did, to their credit, is that towards the end of last year they adjusted the budget and they did somewhat of a bailout, so like a special appropriation to try and fill the gap that was left by PEPFAR.
Has it worked?
Well, I mean, maybe we could say it's too soon to say, because that intervention, they introduced the appropriation in November. So, I mean, it's now February, so we've got about 3 months. So I'm also interested to hear how the president will reflect on that intervention, if he will, in this year's SONA, but also what the government is thinking long term around building an HIV response in this country that is resilient to whoever is, you know, international shocks or whatever it is. That was a once-off injection that the government did. We welcome it in the sense that it's a stopgap measure, but we're trying to build a healthy population. We're trying to build a nation. It's going to be more than just one intervention, and that's what we're looking forward to seeing a state that is committed to rebuilding. And that's not going to be just one fiscal instrument or one gap, but like thinking about how do we ensure that people receive their medication, people receive their antiretroviral treatment, no matter who's the president in this this country or what relationship we have with other countries. So yeah, it's just a moment of reflection for us. But I think that I really don't want us to miss the opportunity to actually rebuild, because we've been on and on the same cycle of political promises and then the real state of the nation, which is felt in our public healthcare sector, telling a different story.
And that health, national health insurance, one of the things that he promised, it is the beginning of the rollout of pilot phase. Lots of talk about a single universal patient information. Has that moved in any way? Has it started? Can we point to a tangible, oh, you said this, this is how far that is?
Yeah, NHI is one of those contentious things because, of course, it was a political promise made. So some parties within the GNU and also in opposition had been proposing it because it is viewed as, or their argument is that it's a way to universalize healthcare access in a country where so many people are struggling to access quality healthcare and we have such inequality. How do we level the playing field? So there was that. But then, of course, there have been many organizations, civil society included, that have criticized the NHI as an act to the point that I think that there are many lawsuits against it. So I think what had happened is that there have been a lot of cases and a lot of litigation and disputes around implementation and many actors who think that this is not ready to be rolled out at the rate at the state that it's in, and it needs to be reworked as an act or needs to be scrapped altogether, depending on who you're speaking to. And I think that's been holding back a lot of the progress. So again, I'm also curious to see what the president will say, because last year it was all about NHI, as you mentioned. A huge part of the health aspects of the SONA was around NHI, and then there's been all this litigation and pushback and contestation around that. I think it is worth looking at how the is the state just pushing back, or are they taking on some of these criticisms so that we can better position our public healthcare system to actually be universal in terms of allocating or accessing healthcare for everyone?
Do you think that the Department of Health has been responsive, you know, with some of this pushback from civil society, from stakeholders within the sector? Have they been responsive in ensuring that people's voices are heard and these changes implemented?
So I think that's one of the areas that like Section 27 and some of our partners are pushing for, is greater public participation so that people's voices can be heard in its rollout. Because it's no point, I think that if we implement something, even if it means, well, it's universal healthcare access, but we're not foregrounding it in the lived experiences of everyday people and experts and everyone who's actually going to use this public healthcare system. If we do that, it's then another imposition. And then we also miss out, and the department will miss out on the opportunity to make better informed decisions. And so we just put advocate for greater public participation, because, you know, it can go ahead and not look like universal healthcare access in the way that was envisioned by everyday people in this country, especially those who are marginalized in rural communities. So I think and I think it's also worth exploring and looking at how civil society itself is engaging and trying to push for greater public participation. You get some actors who are working alongside the state, and then you get some who are holding the state accountable from the outside. So inside and outside actors. And so it becomes a bit difficult to give a universal picture of what civil society is saying. I think it's quite a contentious thing. But what is important is that the Department of Health needs to, and government at large needs to be open to all the different perspectives that people are sharing, yes, as civil society, but also importantly, ordinary users of healthcare.
Well, I want to ask you about the user of the healthcare system. So the mother with the baby at the clinic in the queue.
Yeah.
Between what was promised at SONA last year, what was allocated in the budget and received at the end user level, do you think that the system is more resilient today or more fragile from the promises and what they backed it up with?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. Reflecting within a year, what the experience of, like you said, the mother with the baby at a clinic would be, would it be better last year versus this year? And I think on the one hand, we can point to some interventions that have been good that we've supported. For example, that there has been greater funding towards the clinics, right? That's one end of it, ideally towards healthcare. But if you look at implementation, a lot of these provinces, like I said, these provincial departments, they're in a lot of debt and they struggle, especially in the fourth quarter, to pay out all their debtors because it's been years of underfunding, years of, you know, it's been a chronic underfunding crisis that one budget speech that implements or that tries to bail out, it's just a drop in the ocean to what is needed. And so I don't believe that the experiences of people, and I'm happy to be, we can have this conversation, but I don't believe that it's just shifted overnight in that way, because I don't know how it could be overnight because of how pervasive and how chronic the issue was around underfunding and resource allocation. And so provinces are already, you know, there are problems with, I mean, we've seen they are in debt, but also there's still underspending, and I think we'll still see that there are provinces who are going to apply for rollouts for the rollovers for the next financial year. I think that we still do have those problems, and that's why I think that it's important to, even as listeners and us as ordinary people in this country, to know that, okay, fine, the president will make a State of the Nation address outlining government's priorities. The real state of the nation is how we experience the country every single day. And we need to be holding the state to account. Yes, they often said, oh, but we don't have money for this. We'd love to do this. We don't have money for this. But the right to access healthcare, quality healthcare services is progressively realized. Are we progressing every year? Are we investing more? Are we doing more and more every year? We know that, and the Constitution itself envisioned that it's not going to be overnight that we build this public healthcare sector. But if we're looking at 30 years since the Constitution, have we been progressing? I mean, yes, we've made substantive gains in some areas, but I think that if we're not serious about building and investing, we might actually be derailing the momentum so that the quality of healthcare that the mother with the child at the clinic can improve. I would love to hear commitments also that to rebuilding or increasing the number of doctors and nurses, and because last year at the mother with the baby at the clinic, she would have recognized that there are not enough nurses and doctors, because nurses and doctors were protesting at the time because they were not being hired because of funding allocations. And so hoping that this year, that's something that could change and we could end that cycle. But if we look over the past year, I think that it's too soon to say, and I also do not want to subject the state of the nation to being, again, like those political promises that can't be realized over time. We need to be progressively building a public healthcare sector that captures everyone in this country and really builds a healthy population that can thrive.
So if you were to help the president draft his state of the nation this year, what would be the focus areas that you think he needs to speak about in the healthcare sector?
Yeah, I think what we've been talking about here, actually, rebuilding healthcare access in our communities. You know, like I mentioned, there have been years of disinvestment. There's been a COVID crisis that we haven't, there've been backlogs, and there still are backlogs on infrastructure, backlogs that, you know, there's just on services, a variety of backlogs. Now's the opportunity to say, you know what, we are rebuilding so that to build a healthy population. I think that's one area. And again, looking at communities, I would love to, if I were helping the president, would be prioritizing community health workers and, employment within the public healthcare sector, because I think there are millions of people in this country, young people who are willing and ready to serve their country, but they're not given the opportunity. And I think the state can create those enabling conditions for that, to create that opportunity. But I don't think we do that by trying to reduce the number of doctors, nurses, and teachers for education. But we don't achieve that by reducing the number of community healthcare workers. I think also still on the PEPFAR thing, I would implore that the president doesn't look at it as that happened last year. We did a somewhat of a bailout and then we move on. I would love to hear what we're doing to ensure that our healthcare system in the long run is resilient, that it doesn't matter what's happening internationally, we will still make sure that all our communities can get the healthcare that they need. So definitely, I think a priority should be around rebuilding our public services, rebuilding our communities, because that's really how you build a nation.
Do you think, you've used the word resilient a couple of times. Mm. Do you think that we are open or vulnerable to geopolitical plays in the healthcare sector with the number of NGOs that operate in the sector and where their funding comes from? Ooh. Do you think we are vulnerable as a country?
Hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. And I'd say it's a good question because it's a conversation I think we've also been having within the sector, like with among different players. Because on the one hand, like we saw the shock of it last year, that I think when the story came out around the PEPFAR withdrawal, yes, it was 17%, but 17% is significant in terms of our health response. And I think many people in the country were shocked at the extent of that, right? And I mean, it's one of those tricky things because we, in order to build a country that works for everyone, we do need a capable state, but we also need actors to ensure that the state is capable and is holding, to hold the state accountable. And that's where I envision, at least like the work that I do, is helping, making sure that the state can make better informed decisions and making sure that they don't leave anyone behind and they hold on true to the promises that they've made. And that's what we do as Section 27, is that we have this constitution, the state, progressive realization, access to quality healthcare services. Can you, you know, do that, right? But then at the same time, like you mentioned, there are those, we're in a very interesting geopolitical time. There are trade wars. There seems like silent, you know, a lot of, there's a lot of moving parts that are happening. And it's making, I think, us question, what role are we playing? Are we, and a responsibility also for us as a sector to make sure that we are not just pointing holes and saying, you know, the state is doing this, that's horrible, or this, but we're actually trying to build a South Africa that works. And I think that would mean interrogating, you know, the flows of finances, be it through the more well-known NGOs, but also smaller NGOs. I think there's also been conversation internationally around terrorism financing, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it is one of those where, like, one of those things where both as a country we need to be thinking about, we do need actors to hold the state accountable who are not receiving money from the state also, so that we can hold the state accountable. But at the same time, we also need to make sure that those actors are also acting in the best interest of people, because the work that we do and advocacy, we're speaking on behalf of communities. That's a huge responsibility. Are we being held accountable in making sure that we are also nation building actors and not, you know, internet, you know, working, infiltrating in that way. And I think that it's an ongoing conversation, and especially among like the younger generation of civil society actors, where we're learning and we're trying to build something. We're trying to see what we can contribute towards like a South Africa that works, especially like you mentioned, in this very interesting geopolitical time.
I mean, I think it's hard to believe the president when every year he gets up and does a very flowery sounding Sona speech. In some instances, for instance, when he's talking about jobs, he will give evidence. He'll say, you know, we've 300 jobs for young people over the past 12 months. If you were to point out the kind of evidence that citizens like myself should be listening out for in the health sector when the president speaks so that they can believe him, what would that be?
So evidence, I think, again, a really important intervention that calls for, I think, a citizenry that's active, right? Because what we often do have is that we have a lot of people who criticize public services from the outside, and then you have people who are actually using them. And I think the greatest evidence of the state of the nation, like I said, is the lived experience of people with the healthcare system. And as we're speaking now, I think I did see that there are protests around with doctors again. It's the same story of last year of unemployed doctors. And I think that this is an opportunity to see this is the state of the nation was addressed, was delivered under these conditions. a year later, I think we're still, you know, we still have those conditions. PEPFAR has been withdrawn for the most part. NHI is still something that they'd committed to. You know, again, I think a good question is like, we would love to hear what progress has been made in terms of universalizing healthcare access, where NHI or not, like what progress has been made towards advancing, making sure that everyone accesses healthcare. But I think I would love to see the people story within this, because ultimately I think that's the true experience. So I would love to hear that ambulance access, like they acknowledged that emergency medical service access was dire at this time. This is how much we had last year. This is how much we have this year. I agree with you that it should be a last year versus this year comparison, so that we can look back and see, are we progressive? Are we progressing, and are we progressively realizing that? But for me as a budget activist, ultimately the true evidence will be also with the budget speech, is that there will be these promises, but are you willing to put money behind the promises that you make on behalf of people in this country?
So I wonder if he's going to tell us if Dinswalo got to the hospital in an ambulance this year.
Did
Dinswalo get the ambulance?
I mean, will we hear about Dinswalo this time around? Love to know.
Well, thank you for your time. Thank you for your
thanks for the opportunity. I think it's very important to be having this conversation, because I think a lot of people in this country are disillusioned. It's the same old promises, but we should be looking at what we have at our disposal as a citizenry, especially in an election year, towards advancing and building our building a better country and rebuilding our communities and inheriting, so that the next generation can inherit South Africa that where we have advanced in the same way that we inherited something. Maybe it wasn't perfect, but we inherited some instruments. How can we take it forward and just continue to make progress in this country for the people that we love?
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.